that's at least where I want to take us today, to ask, how is it that we can find joy and wonder in all of our lives all the time, and maybe why we'd even want to try doing that? We're starting this new Sunday series today, and we've called it Inspired, the whole of life with God in the picture. And all fall, we'll talk about the whole of our lives, our work, our housing, our networks of relationship, our strategies for achieving our goals or fulfilling our dreams, and more. And we'll ask, how is it that there can be more in all those areas when God is somehow in the picture? And one of our companions is going to be this little gem of a book from the Hebrew Scriptures called Ruth. And Ruth reads kind of like a fairy tale in some ways, except its writer takes great pains to ground this story very particularly in the history of this nation of Israel, and to fill the account with the kind of people and situations that raise questions about how it is we can find inspiration in all arenas of life. And so this fall, Ruth will give us immigrants and refugees. It will be family drama and local politics. It'll raise issues about the law and about economics and how to manage personal wealth or personal poverty. There'll be efforts we'll see to move out of unemployment, and there'll even be these rather creative sexual advances people are making to try and move out of singlehood. It's a kind of earthy whole life story, this book of Ruth. But it starts amidst crushing tragedy. So where better place to ask if it's possible to find wonder and joy in all our lives all the time than to look at the life of a person who's hit rock bottom? Here's the introduction to this story we'll track with this fall. It's on the inside flap of your program if you want to follow along. And the story begins like this. In the days when the judges ruled in Israel, a severe famine came upon the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah left his home and went to live in the country of Moab, taking his wife and two sons with him. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife was Naomi. Their two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in the land of Judah, and when they reached Moab, they settled there. Then Elimelech died, and Naomi was left with her two sons. The two sons married Moabite women. One married a woman named Orpah, and the other a woman named Ruth. But about 10 years later, both Mahlon and Chilion died. This left Naomi alone without her two sons or her husband. Then Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had blessed his people in Judah by giving them good crops again. So Naomi and her daughters-in-law got ready to leave Moab to return to her homeland. And with her two daughters-in-law, she set out from the place where she had been living, and they took the road that would lead them back to Judah. So here how this begins, and they talk about rock bottom. Our author gives us a clue of just how bad this is going to be when he starts with the line, in the days when the judges ruled. So Judges is the book in the Bible that comes right before Ruth, and it tells the story of how this early federation of 12 Hebrew tribes is basically falling apart. And over and again, this book has this blunt phrase that simply just says, the people did evil. And just before Ruth, the last chapter of that book ends with the scene of murder and human abduction. It's this chapter of absolute mayhem that ends with the line, in those days, Israel had no king. All the people did whatever seemed right in their own eyes. And then Ruth begins right where that left off. There's this famine in the country of Judah. So Naomi and her husband Elimelech, their two sons, are migrants, essentially refugees, really. I think, wow, we in the West have had this wake-up call recently to this multi-year Syrian crisis of just learning about how desperate, how difficult refugee life can be if we're not aware of that already. This stuff that makes up regular life, security, comfort, a familiar relationships, provision, anything we could call home, like it's all vanished as a refugee. And here this book of Ruth throws us right into the middle of that kind of circumstance. So we're in this lawless, brutal, violent age, and Naomi and her family are refugees fleeing famine. Tough enough setup for the story, but then it gets worse from there. First, Naomi's husband dies. Sadness enough to bear, right? But then, as Naomi's sons grow up, they marry two Moabite women. Now, I don't know much about what must have been the beautiful ancient people of Moab, but I know that from a person like Naomi's perspective, from an early Israelite's perspective, this was not a great thing. We'll just say that Israel had this old legend about where the people of Moab came from that involved this incestuous relationship out of which emerged this nation. And so Naomi would have been raised to look down, to say the least, upon people like this. And here her sons are marrying off into this culture. But then the worst of it, Naomi's two sons die as well. Naomi's now a widow in a time and culture where without sons to support you, that equaled destitution. And not only is she a widow, but she has these two foreigner widows in tow with her whose situations would have been as bleak as hers. Not exactly a dream come true. And what does she have left? What's like the thread she has to hang on to? It's that there's a rumor that things have gotten better in her home country, that maybe there's somewhere she can return to where things will go better for her. I developed a kind of affinity for these stories and these Hebrew scriptures when I was young, largely through my dad. I think like these stories, my dad has a kind of emotional tragic streak that runs pretty deep in him, that bonds him and I guess me through him to these stories. But maybe even more significantly, my dad at the time of my birth was a doctoral student in the Near Eastern and Judaic Studies Department at Brandeis University. And my dad likes to brag that he was the first ever Gentile in his particular area of doctoral studies in this largely Jewish department in this largely Jewish university. And my dad never finished that program, but the basement area outside my bedroom was still kind of littered with the artifacts, the remnants of his uncompleted stories. There were stacks and stacks of books on obscure moments in Jewish history. There were both Hebrew and Arabic flashcards he had once studied for his qualifying exams. There were file cabinets full of kind of unpublished dissertation notes, and then Bibles and Jewish commentaries on those Bibles. And this dad of mine was pretty upbeat about my future and my life. He clearly believed in me, but not so much about his own. He was gloomier about his own life. He was unsatisfied with his accomplishments and unreconciled with the parts of his childhood that were kind of barren and cold. Well, just this year, my dad went to this extended family reunion for the first time. And we talked about his family afterwards, some of the stories of which I've heard about before. His mom had this really bleak childhood and a kind of barren inner landscape that left her a really fairly unloving and unkind person in a lot of ways. And his dad was just really silent, didn't speak much, and really didn't know how to prioritize or treasure his kids, his sons. But my dad said that he picked up this perspective on his own family at this reunion that helped him appreciate his family of origin, particularly his father, a little more. He said that when his dad would talk about his childhood, growing up in Depression-era suburbs in New York City, he would talk about how impoverished he was. That was clear, but it was always with a sense of gratitude. He'd talk about the one time that someone gave him a shirt for Christmas, or this Thanksgiving when another family invited his family into their home and gave him a really great meal. And so his stories always centered around the kind of what was given to him, around gratitude. But at this family reunion, my father spoke for the first time with the children of one of his uncles about how their father would talk about his childhood growing up in the same time and the same place as my grandpa. And what they said was that he, their dad, always talked about all that he didn't have, the opportunities and the possessions he was denied and how hard and how embittering that was. And my dad thought that for all the gaps his own father had, he was never bitter. He was sort of always grateful. He always seemed to, as a result, be a few steps ahead of some of his brothers who lacked that for whatever reason. And my dad thought aloud that isn't it so interesting that two people in the same circumstances can leave that situation with very different ways of talking about it, that our own attitudes and dispositions can go in such different directions, even given the exact same circumstances, and making me wonder if perhaps, like, whatever situation we find ourselves in, we always have some options, we always have a choice of part of how that's going to go for us. I've been thinking about how life can certainly be very hard, how it can be a bumpy road, in part because of what's going on in my TV viewing this week. I've been kind of locked in this past week to the launch of the next steps, the career of Stephen Colbert. I'm wondering, has anyone else taken in The Late Show at all this week? Get some hands. Any Late Show viewers this week? All right, slowly coming up, like a slightly higher percentage than our 9:30 service, because maybe you guys don't go to bed quite so early, so that's cool. I was up watching this some as well. And I found this Colbert's take on late night pretty refreshing. I watched his interview with Joe Biden the other night, which was stunning, actually, to me. Biden, of course, has known significant tragedy. Decades ago, he lost his wife and daughter in a car accident. And then this just past year, one of his sons now as well. And politics aside, I just found Joe Biden impressive in this interview as a human being. It was this rare moment where you see someone famous, like acting like a real person and expressing this deep sense of gratitude for his life, this sense of like wonder about his whole journey despite all the tragedies. And I thought this is so interesting because Colbert, as less widely known, is also no stranger to tragedy and gratitude. Colbert's backstory is when he was 10, he was the youngest of 11 kids. When he was 10, his father and the two brothers closest in age to him died in a plane crash. And Colbert was raised alone by his mom in the wake of that accident. And he had this remarkable interview with GQ this summer, where he's asked about these experiences. And he said, it's by my mother's, when he's asked, like, why, like, unlike many other comedians whose kind of humor and art has been shaped by hard circumstances, like, why don't you seem bitter? You seem like a really happy, kind of joyful guy. And he says, well, I kind of am. He's asked why, and he said, it's by my mother's example that I am not bitter. He said, because she wasn't. Broken, yes. Bitter, no. And he goes on to say this. He says, the world is so lovely. He says, I'm very grateful to be alive, even though I know a lot of dead people. And he says, this is just how I've always felt, grateful to be alive. And so that act, that impulse to be grateful, it wants an object. And that object I call God. For me, the Joe Biden, the kind of Stephen Colbert in my life as a kid, was my 10th grade English teacher, Ken Jones. Mr. Jones had us write these weekly journal entries every week, so we get used to writing more often, and he would write back to us every week personally in response to whatever we had to say. And I hadn't been close to a teacher in years, but there's something about this that warmed me to this guy. And so I took these journals kind of more seriously than I had any other homework assignment in a long time. But that year, Mr. Jones became like not just a great teacher to me, but a hero to me as well. See, I'd heard through the grapevine, a lot of us had, that he had lost a daughter a year or two before, that she had died of an illness she picked up while serving in the Peace Corps. And rumor had traveled around, we later found this out, was true, that he had lost his marriage as well, that he and his wife had split up several years before that, however that happened. And so there was kind of a sense of sadness or heaviness that we noticed in Mr. Jones. Said, oh, that must be why. But that year, during our year with him, we heard this shocking news that his son was in the plane that blew up over Lockerbie, Scotland, that kind of infamous incident back then. And so now, during that year we had him, he was without both of his children. My high school chorus, I think it was around the Christmas holiday, my high school chorus sang at his son's memorial that was held locally. And that whole year, Ken Jones was our English teacher. We watched him firsthand grieve. And we watched this man like trying to come to grips with tragedy, even though he wouldn't talk about it very much. And I was pretty stunned at what I saw. Well, my older brother was graduating that year, and his class asked Mr. Jones to speak at their graduating events. And he called his talk, "The Marvelous Incomprehensibility of God." And I think that wasn't kosher in our public school setting, but I think they let Ken Jones do kind of whatever he wanted that year. And so there was his talk, and I don't remember most of it, but I do remember he spoke about the difficulty of sort of having faith and courage and moving on in life when so much in life is incomprehensible, whether it be the events we're surrounded by or the tragedies that occurred in his life or whatever's going on and whoever God is himself. But I still remember this one line from the speech. He was like shaking a little at this point. He grabbed the podium and he said in this climactic moment, he said, "Here I am bereft of children, but not of hope. Here I am bereft of children, but not of hope." Ken Jones, like, just, he became my hero that day. There's no other way of putting it. I'm going to talk more about him in a minute, but I think about these situations. I think, wow, life brings us this crazy mix, right? And we have to figure out what to do about that, if it's possible to still be hopeful people no matter what life brings us, if we can find or maybe even be found ourselves somehow by a God that exists beyond or through or maybe in the midst of all that life offers to us. Jesus tells a story that gives me some imagery for this. This fall, we'll be tracking not just with the ancient narrative in Ruth, but with these parables from Jesus as well. These intriguing stories he tells with arresting images of life with God in the picture. And here's this week's parable. It's that second passage in the inside of your program. It says, here's another story Jesus told. The kingdom of heaven is like a farmer who planted good seed in his field. But that night as the workers slept, his enemy came and planted weeds among the wheat, then slipped away. When the crop began to grow and produce grain, the weeds also grew. The farmer's workers went to him and said, "Sir, the field where you planted that good seed is full of weeds. Where did they come from?" "An enemy has done this," the farmer exclaimed. "Should we pull out the weeds?" they asked. "No," he replied. "You will uproot the wheat if you do. Let both grow together until the harvest. Then I will tell the harvesters to sort out the weeds, tie them into bundles, and burn them, and to put the wheat in the barn." Jesus says, here's how things work with God in the picture. He says, someone, later Jesus will say it's him, is always planting and growing things, planting and growing, and yay for all the wheat, all the good stuff that grows. But sometimes people spot weeds in those fields. And he's basically like, dang, an enemy has done this. How did this happen? So I find, oh, this is comforting. Even Jesus gets fed up and frustrated with what can happen in life sometimes. And these helpers of Jesus think they can just get rid of these weeds that have cropped up and let the good stuff keep growing. But he says, that is impossible. Wait until later. We'll sort it out at harvest time. Now, later on, Matthew says, Jesus extracts this very particular meaning from this story he's told. He says the wheat and the weeds can be kind of like people who are increasingly full of goodness and people who are increasingly full of badness, and how it's not always so easy to tell the difference, and so we shouldn't try. We should trust God to work that kind of thing out in the end. And I think this is an important note to like the churches the first couple centuries who spent a lot of time, for what we can tell, thinking about how to get rid of toxic influences in their communities and how to weed out people who weren't true believers from their communities. And Matthew quotes Jesus as saying essentially, don't do that. Don't even try. Leave judgment of people in God's hands because you will never be any good at it. But I think there's also this broader meaning here as well. Jesus, after all, says these things as parables, as stories, because they're meant to intrigue. They kind of arrest our imaginations with the deepest truths about life. And I think at this most basic level, the story affirms that life is complicated, that no matter how good a season we're in, there's still going to be challenge or pain or just drudgery. No matter how weedy, how fruitful the field is, someone's going to plant some weeds there, and that's going to be okay. Jesus' kingdom of heaven doesn't require perfect conditions. Heaven on earth is not depending on a weed-free field to thrive. We can still have this life of profound joy and wonder regardless of our circumstances. 2 years after that speech my teacher Ken Jones gave, I had this quiet moment with him in his living room. Now the backstory, if you're younger than me, that might make sense of this, is that I grew up at the end of a kind of sometimes creepy, sometimes delightful era when professional adults and kids, it wasn't assumed there'd be all kinds of boundaries in between them. And so like I had this another instance where one of my high school teachers took a buddy of mine and me on a trip for the weekend, no permission to slip. Our parents just like, go for it. And I ended up, like I was told, bring a tux, and I was a performer at the time, I owned one. And I spent the whole Friday night serving cognac and cigars to my physics teacher's college reunion buddies. I was 17 years old, and I think, oh, I've been in schools a lot. Stuff like that doesn't happen so much anymore. Like, it was kind of a wild and fun era. So there you were. So there I am, right, in that era, and I'm in Ken Jones's living room one night. I'm a junior or senior in high school, 16 or 17. It's his new living room because he's remarried that year with a counselor in our school, and that counselor happened to be our class advisor, and I was class president. And so I thought, why don't we invite Steve and his girlfriend over to dinner, like a double date with us again. Sort of not something I did as a teacher, but oh, that's pretty cool. And so my girlfriend and Mrs. Jones are in the kitchen or somewhere, and there are Ken and I in the living room just kind of sitting there waiting, and I don't know what to talk about. And so I say, like, what's this like for you? Like, I look around. I know this home's new to him. So what's it like for you to live here? Like, what's this new life like you find yourself in the midst of? And he gave me this surprisingly deep response. I remember he looked around the room. I think his eyes were tearing up as he did this, and He sort of like touched the chair and pointed at things in the wall, and he said, all this stuff, like it's not mine. You know, like none of this, like how did I get here, right? Like how did I get in this home with these things that aren't mine? Like with this amazing woman who's married me that wasn't mine. He talked about by name her three children, his stepchildren now, all of whom I know, they went to my high school. And he said, these three amazing kids who were never mine, and yet, you know, here I am in their lives, and they're so great, and they welcome me in, and basically teared up and said, like, how did I get this life? Like, that's what it's like. How did I find this amazing life I'm in? And I remember, I don't know how it passed or what came next, but I remember it was this holy moment. Like, one of those moments you think, wow, like, life is coming alive. This incredible moment of grace and wonder that I was welcomed into for a minute. I want to talk about those of us in the room for a minute, how this maybe bumps up against us. So I think some of us have had summers or walking into falls that are just obviously full of beauty and wonder. You've been on some great vacation, or maybe you've just been to the ocean, you had that moment, like Dana was singing about, from the edge of the cliffs of the trees, I believe, like life's good. Or you see your dreams getting bigger and bigger and bigger, as the song says. Some of you, I know, of expecting your first child, or just had a baby, or you're in relationships you love, or school or work's going awesome, or you've just launched a business that's thriving in its early days, and I think, wow, congratulations, these are great things. Sometimes wonder is sort of obviously right in front of us, but some of us have had different kinds of summers. We have different falls in front of us where life seems more bleak or desolate, or maybe it's just mundane. You've suffered loss. Some of us in the room have suffered loss. Some of us are facing messy problems. Some of you tell me about those sometime, and those are really hard. Or maybe you're just bored, like school or work or whatever fills your days isn't particularly intriguing or fresh or isn't especially satisfying at the moment. And I think, wow, well, today's stories tell us, they tell me, that yes, there are always weeds in life. We always have these problems. But there's always wheat, too. There's always this blessing if we can notice it or if we can find it. I feel like Jesus and Ruth and the stories of my grandfather and Joe Biden and Colbert, my old teacher, Ken Jones, they all suggest to me that no matter what life throws our way, there's this possibility of finding joy and wonder and gratitude because we find God has never abandoned the life we're in. We can always find God or have maybe God find us in some way. And we'll talk about this fall in the context of all kinds of circumstances. Next week, we'll talk about finding God in people we might never have expected to find God in. And there'll be, I think, interesting stuff coming your way after that. But I want to wrap up our first talk here with a few steps on finding joy and wonder wherever you are, a few practical notions. This will be where your program notes pick up if that interests you. But here's four invitations I want to pitch your way. One is that you have, and I have, both wheat and weeds in your life. And simply notice them both, the wheat and the weeds, so to speak. Most of us are pretty good at noticing the weeds in our life. We see what's wrong or what's missing pretty evidently. But some of us have a hard time finding the wheat or a hard time giving our attention to that. But I think whatever our tendency is, whether it's to notice the good or notice the bad a little more, it seems important to notice both. I remember hearing once, I think in this church from another pastor here, this phrase I really love, that reality is the friend of God. That reality is God's friend, because all we have is reality. We have this life, this day, this moment we're living in, and that's the only raw material through which we might find more life, through which we might find more wonder and awe, in which God might find us and do something special. And so as we saw with Jesus and some of these stories today, and we'll see with Ruth, that always appears to be good enough for God, whatever that is going on in that life. I think what we don't need to, though, is to deny or spin our circumstances in some way. So we don't have to fake being happy about the lousy stuff, which will be the second slide here. Not fake being happy about the lousy stuff. Some of us have been told, or we've somehow thought, that we have to engage in some kind of mental or spiritual gymnastics to be grateful for all the junk in our lives, as if we're supposed to say, it's great to be lonely or bored or suffer disappointment or tragedy. What a wonderful thing. And I think, I don't know, when the weeds creep into anything good, we see that Jesus himself says, an enemy has done this. This is not a good thing. I think we can do the same thing. We don't have to celebrate whatever junk we find comes our way, whatever mess we're dealing with. But I think we can do something profound there that I've experienced, and I think is the thread holding all my stories today together, which is that we can turn toward the blessing, whatever it is today. This is a more religious phrase than I normally like to lay on you, and to be honest, it makes me mildly uncomfortable, but I'm quoting from Ruth here, and I want to paraphrase. I just want to keep this image there. You remember that Naomi is alone without her two sons or a husband, as the text tells us, and she hears that God has blessed the people back in her hometown of Judah with this really abundant harvest again. The region she once had to leave because of famine is now somehow thriving, and maybe that's the spot where life can go well for her. And so even though she's gone from refugee to kind of settled in Moab by this point in the story, even though it might be humiliating for her to return home with nothing, and we read that she finds out about this news, and then she gets ready to return, sets out, and takes the road back to Judah. And there's all kinds of irony here, as I think there often can be as well for us. I think sometimes finding our blessing can be as simple as practicing gratitude, like my grandfather did and looking back on his childhood, or like Stephen Colbert was doing that interview. But I think we can often find that there might be this that place of blessing, like the thing God wants us to zone in on where the life is, can actually be in the place of a previous or current weakness. As is for Ruth, where she finds out the most abundant food is now available in that place that started off all her pain. It's Ken Jones in the living room, right, where with both of his children dead, suddenly surrounded by these stepchildren and this family and this home, embraced into all of that. This is me just this past week on Thursday morning. I realized I've been this absolutely awful dad to one of my kids. There had been this kind of emotional outburst around some stuff. My kid was being, I think, inappropriate. I still think that's probably true. But my reaction was to shut this kid down entirely, right? Just to be really mean and critical and dismissive of the concerns because I was kind of offended by the way they were being brought up. And as my kid left, and I felt like so disappointed, as my kid was pointing out, that I should feel disappointed, but the kind of dad I was in that moment, I thought, like, this is your good news for me today, God. This is your good news that, like, there's more for me. That, like, I can learn how to not shut down the emotions of people who I'm unhappy with. And maybe there's something that says about myself and how I carry my own emotional life and disappointments. And, like, there's this gift here, God. Like, this, you want me to tune in on this. There's, like, a blessing here. And that's proven true. Lastly, I'd find wherever you find the blessing, whatever it is, milk every bit of praise, awe, and wonder. Just kind of milk it, because I think this might be the point of life. I shared all these stories of loss and gratitude today, partly because they just moved me so much. They're like good stories. I was drawn to telling them. But I think these people that have found gratitude, they can look at a life that's have tragedy in it and be grateful and still say, God, you're there. I've noticed that spot where it's clear you're there. You're good. And this sense of awe and wonder and gratitude kind of overcomes the rest of it for them. I think when you find yourself in that kind of looking at blessing moment, one of these Kayuka's moments, like, I believe, here's that good thing, it's deep and wonderful. Like, take that moment seriously. You know, that's kind of a holy moment. It's stay with that. Like, speak it out to God. Tell God how great that is, whatever else you think of God. Give expression to that wonder you feel. Tell someone about it. Because increasingly, I wonder if that's a big part of the point of life. This remarkable Jewish scholar whose books were around my bedroom growing up, his name's Abraham Heschel. I've shared this quotation before, but I'm going to share it again. I think it's so profound. Abraham Heschel wrote once, our goal should be to live life in radical amazement. Get up in the morning and look at the world in a way that takes nothing for granted. Everything is phenomenal. Everything is incredible. Never treat life casually. To be spiritual is to be amazed. This is where the book of Ruth is going, as we'll see. There's this happy woman who loses it all, and she quite literally renames herself bitterness. And yet then by the end of the story, it ends with her friends telling her life is in fact very good, and she quietly agrees with them. She finds this sense of praise, this sense of awe and wonder in the midst of her circumstances again. I think, I think this is it for us, at least for me, that life is not this puzzle to be solved, right? Life is not this problem to figure out, that we sort of do make all the right moves, smooth all the circumstances over correctly, that like, then we can be at peace and we get rid of all our problems. But life, I think, equally so, is not this sort of stoic journey to just grin and bear up under the weight of all our difficulties, just sort of suck it up and say, well, life stinks, but I will just bear it all in peace without complaint. I think life, the point is neither of those, something else entirely. That all of life is the space in which God can be alive for us, and we can find ourselves, regardless of circumstances, inspired in that. Honestly facing our circumstances, but in the midst of them, still experiencing God in all things and finding joy and wonder in the middle of all of it. And I want to close by praying for us, that that'd be so for us, like this day, this week. Let me pray for us for a minute. Well, our good God, here we are. We're here with whatever story we have, it's all we have. Here we are. And God, my prayer, my hope for each of us in this room right now is that we notice today that here you are too. That we'd notice the cause you've given us for wonder, for awe, to look around our life and say, how did I get here? How is there so much that I'm grateful for? That's a space, God, that I feel like we don't just find, you take us there somehow. So I pray you take us there today. I pray that you'd mark our lives, whether we're in the middle of them or near the end or right at the start, that you kind of do something in each of us that can mark our life journeys by more joy, more awe, more wonder. I pray you would do that, God, for our pleasure and for whatever else good and true comes out of it. In Jesus' name, amen.